Meeting will come to order. Okay, we have a quorum, so I think the first thing we'll do is approval of the minutes from February 12th. Representative Doty?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes from February 12th.
Okay, any discussion on the February 12th minutes? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay. Say, just a reminder to members, I'm not real sure where we're at for deadlines yet, but if you're thinking about some ideas for bills or something, try and get those in, you know, fairly soon. And also, if you want the bills heard, get in the hearing requests too. That's so that way we can tell if it's just a duplicate bill, or if it's just, you know, for some other reason you're introducing a bill, or if it's a serious request. That's the way we can tell the difference. So I'd appreciate that. Okay, members, today we have a Department of Veteran Affairs here, and it looks like from the agenda here, they've done quite a bit of work preparing for this meeting, and we sure appreciate that. We'll start off with the Veterans Home overview, and if I understand right, Ms. Barrows will be doing that. Is that correct? Okay.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam Barrows. I'm the Senior Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm going to be doing an overview of the Minneapolis home, and then sitting with the other, with our statewide home sitting in our Medicare and Medicaid. On behalf of Deputy Commissioner Gil Acevedo, we thank you for this opportunity to share with you a lot of the good things that we're doing. He's not able to be here this morning. We have Dan Steen is our new administrator, and for the Minneapolis Veterans Home, he came on board in October of last year, the end of October of last year. And Dan previously was the commandant of the Iowa Veterans Home, and for 4 years, and he has about 18 years of experience in long-term care in the private sector in Iowa, and so we're very glad to have him on board. And he's not able to be here this morning either, so. But Dan's focus is very much moving the home away from a medical model of care towards a person-centered model. And that model would promote more of a resident involvement, resident choice, more decision making at the resident level instead of us caregivers deciding what we need to do for the residents. They get to choose, and that's a good thing. And as part of that, it's involving the frontline staff more in the care. And one of the ways that we're doing that is by using the LEAN process. As you know, the state of Minnesota has adopted the LEAN as our quality improvement process, and so we've used we're doing a lot of Kaizen events and LEAN 101 training for our staff to get them more involved in a lot of the change process at the home, and we're very pleased with how that's going. As you may be aware, we had a CRIPA investigation, which is the Civil Rights of Institutional Persons Act, and they originally came in February of 2009, made some recommendations, came back in December, a follow-up visit just to see how we were progressing, how Minneapolis was progressing on those recommendations. And very pleased with the progress. As far as they were concerned, only two of the original participants came back, a nurse practitioner and the lead attorney. And their recommendation is probably that they're going to recommend closing the case, but that's not up to them. So we haven't heard back from them, but we're hopeful that it will be closed, and that will be the end of that process. We had a VA survey in December, and that also went very, very well. The VA survey team was very, very pleased with the conditions at Minneapolis and the improvements that have been made from their previous. They come annually. I might mention that the VA, as nationally, is going to a new process for doing the surveys. In the past, each home of jurisdiction would send their own team in and do a survey of the homes. Like for the Minneapolis VA would survey the Hastings Veterans Home, the Minneapolis Veterans Home, and the Silver Bay Veterans Home. Sioux Falls would do the Laverne and so on. But because of the variation in the surveys across the country, the VA has decided that they are going to contract with a survey group, and they've done that and started that process. And it's Asselon Corporation in Landover, Maryland. And they'll conduct the clinical and life safety components of the survey for all the state veterans' homes. And the local VA of jurisdiction will have two team members from that local VA accompany them. The team size will be 5 to 7 people, and it'll be 2 to 4 days. For the Minneapolis, for instance, for the Minneapolis VA survey, Veterans Home Survey, I think there were about 14 team members that came from the VA, so it should be an improvement in the process of that survey. And Minneapolis is waiting for their Department of Health survey. We're in that window and expect it any time. For Building 9, which is the 100-bed, it was the building that was demolished, and a new 100-bed skilled nursing facility is being built in that location. The contractor has been selected. They're going out for the subcontractor bids right now, and the groundbreaking is expected in the beginning of May. The design of that is a neighborhood concept, again, to promote the social model of care, person-centered care. And it'll be like 2 8-bed units together, and that will have its own living space, kitchenette, dining space, that type of thing. So each unit will be those 2 8-bed units or 16-bed units. And all of the rooms in that building will be single rooms, with their own bathrooms. So that is going to be a huge improvement. It will also have a town center, and it'll support a community concept as well as focus on the military heritage. And then Building 4 is that is a historic building that will be turned into an adult daycare program. And we'll be able to serve up to 35 residents at any given time. And groundbreaking for that should be in the beginning of April. So a lot going on the campus. And working with the Historical Society on both of those buildings to make sure that we carry on that focus. And the last thing is that the department has hired an internal auditor, and that internal auditor has started looking at some of the findings from the Minneapolis audit, OLA audit, and working through those, making sure that we're making progress on some of those findings, and so that's been helpful for the financial department. And that's pretty much the update on the Minneapolis home, and I would be open for any questions.
Any questions, members? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple years ago, we had some problems with the medical delivery
at the Minneapolis Nursing Home. And has there been a repeat audit? I think you just mentioned an audit. Have all those been resolved, and has there been a revisit of that process, and how has that, can you give us some information on the improvements that have taken place? And I think you guys have done a fabulous job, but can you speak a little bit to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Now you're talking about the medical care as opposed to the, as far as the Department of Health and the VA, you know, they've come back a couple of times. And have been we've been cleared of any findings from the Department of Health originally that created the problems a couple of years ago that you're referring to. The type of findings that they're that the VA found was worms in the fishing worms in the resident. Refrigerator, you know, those types of things.
Special diet.
Yeah. Well, we got a lot of fishermen up there. anyway, you know, I mean, it's minor things that, you know, they're still finding things, but they're minor things as opposed to the major deep things. And we can always make improvements on the hand washing and the you know, a lot of the documentation issues, those types of things, there's always room for improvement. But I'll be introducing Robin shortly. Robin is our quality director for the department, and the quality improvement process in Minneapolis has changed dramatically. They have team meetings, they have quality meetings on each of the units. To look at issues, to look at falls, to look at a lot of the different things that some of it is the deep care issues, which I think that we've done a fabulous job of improving, and then a lot of it is the documentation to make sure that we can prove that we're doing what we're doing. The folks that work there. I've had the honor and pleasure of filling in a couple of times as the interim administrator, and it has been amazing to see the quality of folks that work there. They do a fantastic job. The nursing assistants and the housekeeping and dietary staff, they really, really care. And so it's just putting those structures and those supporting pieces in place, and that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years to make sure that we give them the tools and the opportunities to give the good care our vets deserve. So,
just to follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair, yeah, and I did, I think we made a tremendous investment in Mr. Acevedo,
yes.
Dragging him out from San Diego. I know he's probably. Not real happy about the weather, but he's done a great service for Minnesota, and I think the VA has done a tremendous job in turning that whole thing around, so thank you very much.
Thank you. And I would agree wholeheartedly with that. I've been with the vets' homes for a long time, and he's truly an exceptional person to have on board for us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Bowles. When you have a veteran who's at the home who's ill enough to require hospitalization, do you take them to the VA or do they go to HCMC?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it depends on if the VA will accept them. But for the most part, they probably go to HCMC and then are transferred to the VA. But that's kind of driven by the VA hospital, and whether that particular veteran is qualified to get their care at the VA, you know, if they've got a disability rating. But for the most part, they probably go to HCMC to start out with, or another Twin City hospital.
Mr. Chair, if I can just follow up, you know, we had our discussion yesterday on the general assistance medical care. And one of the things that was being discussed is to take veterans who are currently receiving that care off the care and get them to the to the VA, but if the VA is not accepting these people, then I think we have to relook at this and perhaps talk with the VA and see what we can do to, because it sounds good, you know, we're going to move 8,000 people into another into the VA, but if the VA neither has space nor they will accommodate the people, then we have to look at it again. So thank you very much.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we all can agree that the strength of a nation is really comes down to how we treat our veterans at all stages of their life. And my wife and I have a home up in Silver Bay. And just a couple of months ago, I had the honor to take a tour through the facility there. And Carol Gilbertson, just a fine lady up there, just does an outstanding job and organized. They're going through construction phases right now. Just to walk through the facility, see how they've made improvements and additions. And Silver, the little town of Silver Bay is pretty proud of their veterans home up there. Could you comment anything about what's going on in Silver Bay?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. They're doing, as you may or may not be aware, Silver Bay is the veterans home in Silver Bay is a converted schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. And for a schoolhouse, they've done a fantastic job of trying to make that a home. But again, because it was a converted schoolhouse, there wasn't a whole lot of storage. There wasn't a whole, it just didn't meet the needs of what they needed to do to provide the best care that we can give to our veterans. So they're doing a fairly major stage renovation project. They've added a couple of private rooms. They're changing their dining area, their recreation area, getting some storage in there. Again, just trying to make it more suited to be able to deliver the care that they need. And it's in a couple of phases. But unfortunately, you know, as part of the issue is because it's a renovation. You know, it's not as going to be as clean as going into, you know, some of the structural things. So they, you know, they have, it's taking longer, I think, than they anticipated, just because they find things that they had no idea that they're going to find. But they're doing a good job in keeping on top of it. And Carol does a wonderful job and has brought a lot of that social focus of care and a lot of enthusiasm and her mind never stops. I mean, she's always trying to make improvements and good addition for that home.
Mr. Chair, just follow up, and I know that she has done a great job getting the community volunteers that come in mm-hmm. come in on Sunday morning services with local churches and. Mm-hmm. It's just been a. If you get a chance to get out and see some of our veterans' homes, please do that because it's something that we all should take advantage of visitations. Thank you.
Anything further, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Severs.
I think it might be just as Representative Newton was talking about. It might be advantageous for us to kind of do some delving in and talk with the VA, our Minnesota VA, to interface with the federal VA to find out if there's some language glitch or there's something that would preclude these individuals from going directly to the VA in terms of priority. And I think that would be something that you could help us out with in terms of if there's just an administrative disconnect here, something that we can kind of help with and interface with the federal side to make sure that these individuals don't meet any barriers as they're trying to receive immediate medical attention through the VA. I mean, it's just across the road. Why would we ship them all the way over to a local hospital and then ship them back over to the VA? It just seems like there's some efficiencies that we may be able to realize there.
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can certainly look at that, correct?
Okay, anything further? Any closing comments on this?
No, I don't. I would like to move ahead to our Medicare Medicaid study with Senator Robbins up here. But I want to give you a little background about Robin. Robin has been with the department for about a year, a little over a year, and she comes to us with extensive background in quality improvement, and particularly in the private sector in healthcare. And so she's really done a tremendous job, not only with helping us in Minneapolis, but also with all of the homes in our quality improvement process. And Robin was the lead in doing our Medicare Medicaid study, and so she'll give that part of the presentation.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Robin Gaustad. I'm the Director of Quality Services for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs and the Minnesota Veterans Homes. I think you have a handout, a PowerPoint handout regarding the presentation that I'm going to give. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the RFP process, the methodology that we used relative to the study, as well as kind of review. We approached the study in three phases, review those phases, as well as talk about some of the findings, and also give you an idea of where we are now, kind of the so what, so where do we go from here. So that was what I was going to try to accomplish today. In terms of the RFP process, we started that early first quarter in 2009. We sent out an RFP following the state procedure and process, and ended up contracting with an organization called Affinity Health Services. Affinity Health Services joined our leadership team in April of 2009 and finished their work in early November 2009. The first phase of our project was really the data gathering, trying to identify the cost per patient day at each of our homes. The study actually looked at all of our veterans' homes, and we did an individual analysis for each home and then a roll-up analysis at the end, looking at the feasibility to become Medicare Medicaid certified. After we identified those costs per patient day, we tried to realign those financial reports to industry standard, including other veterans' homes as well as community-based Medicare-certified homes. That helped us to establish the basis for determining the Minnesota Veteran Home financial impact for the study. In phase two, we actually broke phase two into two parts, 2A and 2B. Both of those parts had to do with a deeper analysis of the data, and in phase 2A, we looked at the analysis of operational considerations. So what would it be like for the Minnesota Veterans Homes versus Medicare-certified homes in the community? There were several key points that fell out of that phase 2A. One of the first things was that our Minnesota Veterans Homes are guided and accountable to Chapter 9050 of our rules and reg statutes, looking at the admission criteria as well as waiting lists for veterans who want admission to the veterans' homes. Those are what guide our admission process. In terms of community-based homes, what guides their admission process is really they get their admissions from marketing in the community, their reputation in the community, and mouth-to-mouth kind of passing on of information and recommendation from families to families. We also found that in the Minnesota Veterans Homes, we have fewer admissions than community-based homes and longer lengths of stay. The community-based Medicare-certified homes typically have higher turnaround and shorter lengths of stay. And that's really because in terms of the Veterans Home's mission, when our veterans come to the Minnesota Veterans Home, they look at that oftentimes as their home for the remainder of their life. So our lengths of stays are years and decades versus typically months or a short period of time, a year to 18 months. So a very different mission for the veterans' homes versus community-based homes. And that's a pretty key point for us. One of the key findings was that our admission criteria and waiting list process practically eliminates the ability of our veterans' homes to admit residents directly from hospitals, taking advantage of this 3-day hospital stay requirement for Medicare Part A. Medicare Part A lays out several very stringent requirements, and obviously CMS has creates those definitions. The three requirements include the fact that the resident must need skilled nursing care or skilled rehab on a daily basis, and they have a high acuity need for those services. Those daily skilled services will only be able to be provided in a skilled nursing home setting, so they cannot get those services anywhere else, whether at home or in some other kind of transitional setting. And the services must be reasonable and necessary to treat an acute illness or injury. So it's really about acuity in terms of Medicare certification and being able to bill Medicare. In terms of our findings relative to Phase 2A, we found several things. One, that our admission practices vary significantly between our homes and what you might find in community-based Medicare-certified homes. Obviously, our discharge planning practices also vary significantly, and that's because our residents come to us with that long-term stay mentality. They're coming there to live out their days with us. Whereas in the community-based homes, their goal is really that turnover of residents to enhance revenue. The length of stay varies as well, and we've talked about that a little bit. Acuity levels vary significantly at our veterans' homes versus our neighbors in the community. And part of that, again, is because our residents come to us looking for a place to live long-term. So their health care is going to ebb and flow according to their individual health care needs. Overall, in Laverne and Fergus Falls, we found that the acuity rate is lower than some of our other homes, so they have kind of the lowest acuity rates, whereas Minneapolis, because probably of numbers and location, has a little bit higher acuity in terms of needs of our residents. The therapy services also vary significantly in terms of the level of services. At our veterans' homes, we probably provide more therapy to more residents based on clinical needs versus based on the need to be able to enhance Medicare billing opportunities. So in our private community homes, they're going to use their resources relative to enhancing billing opportunities to enhance revenue. And at our veterans' homes, we really provide those services based on what we feel the clinical need is for the residents. So it gives us, a different approach versus relative to our mission. Obviously, then, our documentation needs
Excuse me. We have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you just said, Ms. Glosted, brings up a question I had in my mind is how you, okay, in the regular nursing home, the more care a person needs, basically, the higher they charge you, the higher rate they charge you. How are the rates determined at the veterans' homes? Is that similar? I mean, can you go into that a little more?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, at the Minnesota Veterans Homes, we do a cost of care calculation, and that cost of care calculation is based on the relative expenses at each of our homes. So the cost of care calculation varies a little bit in between our homes based on kind of their overhead and their operational costs. And then from there, based on the veterans' disability rating, whether or not they've served in a wartime setting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a that all is included in the cost of care calculation. And then what we find is what comes from that is that the per diem that the federal, that the feds will pay for each resident may vary slightly. And then what's left over, there's a maintenance fee that's, or an out-of-pocket fee, if you will, that's paid then by the family. Pam, would you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, basically we have one charge. And depending upon their ability to pay is what they pay. But we don't charge based on, it doesn't vary from resident to resident based on need. It's the same for every resident. And that changes annually. And the one of the differences is that we include medication costs in that annual cost of care, which private, you know, it's a separate billing in the private sector. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but no, if somebody needs a whole lot of therapy versus a little therapy, their general charge is going to be the same. What they pay may be different, but that's based on their income and assets.
And I thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, you know, certainly you brought up a key point, I thought, when you talked about the situation with the Medicare. You know, you have to be coming basically almost directly from the hospital or with a 3-day stay. Mm-hmm. And is that affecting your the operations of the homes here now? I know that the waiting list varies at the homes across the state, and if we could get some recent numbers on that would be helpful too, so we got an idea how much backlog there is out there. That would be helpful to us, because I know it varies from the homes across the state, but if you can get a little bit of a trend line description to us, that would help, because this is something I'm interested in, because if folks come, well, Pam, you know it in Laverne, when you managed it in Laverne, that we come from the hospital there, and you almost can't take them, you know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, actually, I just looked at those numbers, so Minneapolis's waiting list is in the 250 range. Fergus Falls is about a little over 100. Laverne is probably in the 60s, mid-60s, and Silver Bay is fairly low. And most of that is for their dementia care unit. They run a fairly low waiting list there. But the other three skilled homes have a fairly extensive waiting list. As far as Medicare Part A, and Robin will get into that a little bit, you know, for the smaller homes, it wouldn't be beneficial to us very much. So, but Robin can address that.
Yeah. Okay. Any follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's been a concern of mine as these veterans that have needs coming directly out of the hospital when they really need the help, and they're not able to get in the nursing home. Mm-hmm. And so that it is a concern. I don't know what we do with it, Mr. Chairman, but it's something maybe we can give some thought to. Maybe we can come up with something. I don't know. But as Representative Newton said earlier, with some of the veterans' care needs we have out there, certainly the older folks here that are, when they get out of the hospital, in fact, we're all getting older, I guess. when we get out of the hospital and we really need to care, it pretty much knocks us out of going to the veterans' home. So it's something I'd like to see some progress on. Maybe we can change the waiting list formula or whatever. I don't know. But it's not a good situation.
Yeah. Okay, Ms. Barros.
Mr. Chair. So anyways, a lot of our processes differ. Our business and accounting processes vary as well, again, because we don't do third-party payer billing. We do the cost of care calculation. It's pretty straightforward, so we don't need, at this point in time, sophisticated accounting and business office kinds of practices in terms of having to do complicated third-party payer billing. So in Phase 2B then, moving on, we actually also did an analysis of our financial and business office operations, because that's a pretty big piece of requirement in terms of being able to do Medicare and Medicaid billing. Medicare requires what they call a cost report, and that cost report is a very structured accounting of costs and revenues in terms of general ledger and accounting systems. So we found pretty quickly that our accounts receivable and billing policies and procedures would need a lot of work. Again, to the representative's point, we do cost of care calculations mixed with some private pay maintenance fees as well as federal per diem versus that third party billing. And we also looked at our computer systems as well as equipment needs, and found that we were somewhat lacking there. So as a result of all of that, we found that many of our systems vary significantly from what you might find in a community-based Medicare home, where they have many more sophisticated systems, both billing and computer systems. Moving on to Phase 3, Phase 3 is really kind of that so what kind of question. We did a cost-benefit analysis and looked at a potential implementation plan if we were to move in the direction of Medicare, Medicaid certification. We started there with a gap analysis relative to what Medicare refers to as conditions of participation. And those are really those CMS rules and regs that regulate Medicare certified nursing homes. And we needed to see where we were relative to those current rules and regs. So we went out and did mock surveys. The consulting firm actually conducted the mock surveys. They spent a week or so in each of our homes doing that work. And they also did life safety code walkthroughs, looking at the physical plant and environment. We had to look at expenses in two ways. One, we looked at expenses for the cost-benefit analysis, looking at the cost per resident day using Minnesota Veterans Home's current expense data and structure. And then we looked at expenses, trying to align them with more community-based homes that were Medicare certified. And that information was provided by Affinity through analysis from information they had in a database. Some of that information coming out of cost reports for community-based homes. And then again, we've talked about where revenue would need to come from. Obviously, we don't have the same comparable revenue because of our maintenance fees and our federal per diem approach. So they pulled information from Medicare and Medicaid rates and wherever possible used Minnesota rates and information. We then looked at two scenarios. The first scenario was an analysis and summary of the cost benefit for the veterans homes if they pursue Medicare certification with no change to our admission criteria and waiting list rules. The conclusion there was clearly that three out of four of our current nursing homes would not benefit from participation in Medicare Part A under the current admission criteria. These homes could potentially benefit from participating in Medicare Part B and Medicare Part D being the pharmacy piece. The second scenario we looked at was an analysis and summary of the cost benefit for the veterans home to pursue certification and seek revision of our admission criteria and our waiting list rules. The most important thing to note there is that in that second scenario, there would be a tremendous impact and a change of mission for our Minnesota veterans homes. which is currently to serve the long-term care needs of our residents and family, looking at our homes as a long-term care, a long-term living arrangement. So in summary, in terms of phase three, we found that in order to proceed, we would probably incur some more investment costs to become Medicare certified relative to the implementation plan that Affinity worked on for us and with us. Some of those costs would be upfront costs, so one-time costs, and some of those costs would be ongoing costs, things that we would need to put in the system and that we would see then as additional costs on an annual basis. If we were to proceed, we would probably need more consulting time. We're working on what the construct of that would look like and what we would then put in as parameters for a second request for a proposal. We would need to upgrade our computers and our software and equipment. We would need extensive dollars for training for all of our staff, both clinical and non-clinical, including focus on clinical skills, HIPAA, and ongoing compliance with Medicare certification rules and regs. We would need some additional ongoing FTEs, some for billing and some for training, and then to revamp our system policies and procedures. So then I'm sure that the question is, where are we now? In terms of where we are now, the homes are aggressively pursuing looking at Medicare Part D and the opportunities there around pharmacy costs. Pam's leading that effort along with many of our administrators, and we're looking at everything from a centralized pharmacy approach to some actually remote dispensing. So we're well on the way there. In terms of Medicare Parts A and B, we're assessing the feasibility and cost benefits separately based on the merits for each of our homes. We need to understand specifically rehab services, skilled nursing services, and physician services. We need to look at contracting for services versus providing them in-house. So we're doing a more in-depth analysis, making sure that we're moving forward in a thoughtful manner. In terms of Medicaid, again, we're doing the same thing, looking at the cost benefit separately on the merits for each of our homes. So our goals are to move forward with a phased approach that positions us for success both short-term and long-term. What we don't want to do is try and fail, so we want to make sure that we have a win at the end of the day. And we want to move forward in such a way that we honor the military service of our veterans and the needs of our residents and families. So that's kind of what we're about right now.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gusted. Representative Doughty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about a cost saving by going to Medicare Part D, you're referring to a cost saving to the state of Minnesota then, because VA gets to bargain for drug prices and Medicare Part D is prohibited from doing that. And so the total cost to somebody someplace is going to be greater for those drugs, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Fergus Falls facility actually proceeded about a year ago now with looking at the opportunity to utilize residents' Medicare Part D benefits for residents who have that kind of opportunity, and went to and worked with each of the residents that they identified that might qualify for Medicare Part D, and working with the families actually moved to a model wherein they were able to reduce costs for pharmacy services, for drugs, for medications for residents, by utilizing Medicare Part D benefits to pay for those, so that the homes, so that that home in particular was no longer funding pharmacy or medication costs for some of their residents, and so when I talked about cost savings, that's the kind of cost savings. Pam, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, Ms. Chair, Representative. One of the things is, we would, if we center,
if we start billing for Medicare Part D for our residents, we can still obtain and keep our own internal pharmacy. We can still get our drugs at federal pricing, and then we would be reimbursed, billing Medicare Part D, we'd be reimbursed whatever that reimbursement is. So it would be a major cost savings for us, and probably even in that scenario, not for Fergus Falls the way they're doing it, because they're not gaining the revenue, but for us, we could gain the revenue. So it would be a revenue enhancement for us.
So, Mr. Chair, so we are not then, I'm really glad to hear that last part, if I understood it right, that we're not then just passing along a higher bill to Medicare than we would have paid totally here anyway. We are allowed to bill at VA rates. That's correct?
We would, Mr. Chair, Representative, from my understanding, and a lot of the homes across nationally are moving towards this process also. We would get our drugs at our normal rate. We would buy off the federal VA contract. We would bill Medicare based on whatever that reimbursement Medicare gives us for those drugs. And if we buy it at 2 cents and they pay us at 5 cents, we'd get a 3 cent revenue. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. We wouldn't be charging Medicare anymore, but we would gain the difference from, say, a local pharmacy if they buy it at 4 cents and we get it at 3 cents, whatever that drug price is. We have an advantage because we're buying off the federal contract.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question again about the availability and the price of the drugs. If I assume you have some veterans there that are on TRICARE, retired veterans.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would assume so, but at this point we haven't really identified those because it hasn't been an issue. So, you know, those we'd have to be looking at. You know, in the past we've provided all that. So the types of insurance, private insurance that they've had, it hasn't really entered into how we bill them.
You know, I guess, Mr. Chair, the question really is if they are on TRICARE, they're entitled to drugs at $3 a prescription, and they can get it from an outside pharmacy. They wouldn't have to go through your pharmacy. And also, I think veterans who receive pharmacy services at the federal VA also pay roughly $3 a prescription. And I don't know if you have people in your facility that go to the federal VA for health services, but if so, I'm just looking to see if there's some way to keep this even less expensive, and that you provide the pharmaceuticals only for those veterans that can either go to the federal VA or aren't qualified for TRICARE.
Ms. Burrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. Part of the problem with utilizing that scenario is that those drugs would come in a 30, 60, 90-day non-unit dose, and it creates, from a nursing perspective, it creates a real problem in medication administration. A lot of the folks at the Hastings Veterans Home, for instance, were getting their drugs that way, and as a resident with nursing responsible for medication administration, to have multiple sources of getting drugs into that medication administration system, it creates a real nightmare. For the folks, particularly in the skilled units, by providing a unit dose system. For most of, we apply for aid in attendance for those that qualify, and we would be reimbursed from the VA for those, that medication for those residents. For the other residents, they don't pay for their drugs anyway. We provided that. So to do it for all of the skilled residents that would qualify for getting their drugs through the VA in that kind of a system would have created a medication administration nightmare, and you'd really see us getting dinged off the wall by the Department of Health and everybody else. The medication administration process that we use now is a workable process, but I think if we go to a centralized billing and start billing Medicare Part D, we still maintain a good system for medication administration, but we also can, and we would bill other third-party payers too, if they had other insurance, but this way, I think, is the best of both worlds, because we keep our costs down and we gain a revenue source.
Thank you very much.
Okay, anything further? Anything further from either of you?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. Ms. Burrows?
Mr. Chair, Dennis Devereaux is our legal analyst, and he is the person that played the lead in our statewide siting study, and you don't have a copy of that study, but it is online, and Dennis will give an overview of that process.
All right, thank you, and welcome, Mr. Devereaux, and identify yourself.
Yes.
For the tape.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Dennis Devereaux. I'm the legal analyst for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Minnesota Veterans Homes. And I'm going to speak about a study that was done regarding the community identification for possible new veterans homes. About a year ago, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs conducted a competitive process, RFP, to select a consultant to do a community identification study. Now, this study was not done to direct that a home be built in any particular community or whether a new veterans home be built at all. That decision is up to the legislative process, Senate, House, Governor. It was done to identify those factors that are most important to consider in constructing and operating a new veterans home. It was done to create a tool chest. To begin with, to start the study, we looked at what's the most important factors to consider in siting a new veterans home. And the first factor is federal financial participation in the construction. Now, the United States Veterans Administration Construction Grants Program will provide up to 65% of construction costs for a new state veterans home. And under the regulations of that program, there's a requirement that there be a minimum separation between existing state veterans homes. So what we did overlay maps through the consultant, looking at where the five veterans homes are now located and looking where the gaps are, the minimum distance required by the federal regulation. Next most important factor to consider is proximity to a federal Veterans Administration medical center or a federal community-based outpatient clinic. Again, we did the maps and did an overlay there. Those facilities are very important to operating a home because our residents receive services there, and the homes partner with those organizations on a great many projects and services that we provide. The third factor that we considered in this first phase was a local acute care hospital that has an emergency room that is easy access for veteran residents that need acute care. We ran through those calculations, those overlay maps, and came up with a list of 27 communities that met that criteria. The next step of the process, we looked at demographic and operational considerations. First, we looked at the number of veterans in each particular area. We set a minimum of 10,000 veterans and active National Guard within a radius of each of these communities. Next, we looked at adequate numbers of registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and certified nursing assistants, so we would have people available to staff a home. And we got information from the Department of Health licensing database regarding zip codes as to where these people resided. Lastly, we looked at numbers of doctors, dentists, psychologists, psychiatrists, and again looked at licensing data to determine the availability of those people in each area. We ran through the maps again, overlays, and came up with a final list of 17 communities that met all of these criteria. Now, any one of these 17 communities would be a suitable location for a state veterans home. Lastly, in determining the final ranking, 1 through 17, we looked at the single most important factor in siting a state veterans home, and that was proximity to a VA, federal VA medical center, or a federal community-based outpatient clinic. We calculated the distance numbers for each of those in the state, St. Cloud, Fargo, Sioux Falls, Minneapolis, and then the CBOX in the various communities. And we came up with a final ranking, and that's in our study, which we have available on our website for anyone to read the complete study. In conclusion, this study was not done to identify a particular community to locate a new veterans home. It was done to determine what factors should be considered in making a decision to site a future veterans home. We looked at federal financial participation. We looked at the number of local veterans needing services, and then lastly, adequate trained medical personnel to provide those services. Would be happy to take any questions regarding this.
Thank you, Mr. Deverell. Questions, committee members? To start off with, I have a question. I know that one of the communities I represent is interested in building a veterans home, and they're understandably impatient, you know, in a hurry. Why can't this get done fast? And I know this questioner may not be an exact answer to it, but assuming the legislature or governor actually selected a site, once that happened, do you have an estimate on how long it would take to actually begin the construction, that type of thing?
Mr. Chairman, we can collaborate okay. on the answer. We would make application to the federal construction grants program. Each year they set a priority list of what will be funded, and it depends on what all of the states submit for projects, and it depends on how much funding that they have for that particular year. They look at life safety projects first, that is, things that are necessary to keep people safe and providing services, such as roofing, sprinkler systems, things like that. Those are the top priority. And then they work down the list based on their particular criteria. So it changes every year as to how close to the top of the list any particular project would be. So it's somewhat of a guesstimate that needs to be reevaluated each year as funding becomes available and as other projects are submitted. Pam, may comment on funding we've received for Fergus Falls. How long was that in the hopper? I believe it was a couple of years.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that was, I think, several years, and the only reason that it got funded as rapidly as it did is because it had the one-third already, but it was the stimulus funding that brought that one forward. To answer your question, assuming that it has the legislative approval, the governor's approval, the one-third funding, and it gets to the Category 1 on the list, and then, you know, again, as Dennis said, it depends on how much money is put forth at the federal level for and that's been running anywhere between about 85 to 100 million a year. And the total projects on that list are probably in the $250 million range. But assuming that it's there on that list and gets funded, then it has to go through the design and approval process. So, you know, minimum would probably be 18 months from that point.
Yeah.
So it's not a fast process.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's I know that was a difficult question to give an exact answer to, but I appreciate that. With the funding too, there's the question of obtaining, well, first of all, the state or the local community coming up with the local share and then the state match for the actual construction along with the federal match. But then there's the question of the ongoing expense of running an additional home. Does that funding need to be approved before it's given serious consideration for construction?
Mr. Chair, committee, yes. As we put those projects forward, their operating dollars are on that. You know, I mean, that's an assumption that I think has to be made by the legislators and the governor if they're going to move forward with adding another home, is the commitment to the operational funding. And quite frankly, if we don't get it, if we don't open the home because we don't have the operational funding, we have to pay that money back. So we're liable for it, so one way or the other.
Yeah, and that makes sense, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would have to go together. Mm-hmm. I can understand that. Any questions from other members? Okay, well, thank you. I should say I think it was a good study. I mean, you obviously put some time and effort into it, and I think it was a good study with some good results and guidelines. And I know there's a number of communities in the state interested in projects, and I suppose it gives the community something to look at as a guideline and what the expectations are. But again, good job. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for this opportunity.
Sure, thank you. Okay. Cemetery update, is that? Mr. Swantek, welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is David Swantek. I'm the cemetery director at our current state veterans cemetery located in Little Falls. The facility in Little Falls has been in operation since the summer of 1994. In that time, we've provided burials for 3,146 veterans and their eligible dependents, spouses mainly. During the past fiscal year nine, we provided a total of 282 burials. 189 of those were veterans, 93 were eligible spouses or dependents. We're a busy facility. Outside the metro, we provide probably more burials in a cemetery than any other cemetery in the state outside the metro area. We're proud of what we do. We offer this as a final benefit, an honor to our veterans. Every month we submit a plot allowance application to the federal government. They provide a $300 plot allowance payment back to us for every veteran that we bury. Part of that process is an application to the regional office at Fort Snelling. And if they don't have a veteran in the system, they call us and ask for a copy of a discharge for that veteran. What that indicates to us is that we've provided burial for a veteran that has never sought any other benefit from the state or federal government. So it's a final, it's the one and only thing that the veterans ever asked for as far as benefits. So we're happy to be able to provide that as a final tribute to the veteran service. New things that are on the horizon for us, there has a couple years ago the governor was interested in having another state veteran cemetery and was proposed to be located in northeast Minnesota in the Duluth area. We went to work on determining what demographics in that area were, the veteran population. And what we look at when we do that is we place a 75-mile radius around existing cemeteries. In Minnesota, that would be Fort Snelling National Cemetery and then the current cemetery in Little Falls. Any counties, the way we did the study, any counties that circle touches, we consider to be served. The National Cemetery Administration considers those counties to be served by an existing open cemetery. In doing that, it really identified all four corners of the state really are unserved: the northeast, the northwest, the southeast, and the southwest. We talked with the National Cemetery Administration, and they kind of indicated that, based on the demographics that they had, the northeast made most sense, and thus the proposed project in that area by the governor is one of his veterans initiatives. I believe that would be 3 years ago here already. And then last year, in response to a request from Senator Vickerman's committee, we went and presented the information on what may be potential areas in the southern part of the state. And dividing the southern part of the state into two regions, southeast and southwest, the population showed that they were high enough down in both of those areas as well to justify support through a grant from the National Cemetery Administration as well. As the federal government has a grants program for veterans' homes, they also have a grants program to construct state veteran cemeteries. We have made pre-application for a new cemetery in both the northeast and southwest region based on the population in those areas. And we are currently looking for sites in both of those areas. Initially, we had identified a site in northeast Minnesota. Unfortunately, after a little bit of groundwork, we determined that the access into the property, which was state-owned property, it was on the southern edge of Jay Cook State Park near Renshaw, Minnesota. The access wasn't large enough. We started discussions with the adjacent property owners, and after several months of negotiation, we walked away from that property. One adjacent property owner was absolutely opposed to having the cemetery in his backyard, essentially, and the other property owner used his property for hunting ground, 40 acres, and just wasn't interested in selling off a portion of it to widen the access to an appropriate width for our needs. So we're still looking for property in Duluth. We've identified between the DNR and the St. Louis and Carlton counties, we've identified about 12 sites that we've looked at over the last couple of years. Mainly, DNR sites are already state-owned property, and the sites identified by the two counties up there are mainly tax forfeit property that would possibly be available to us for this use. The Duluth area, it's a challenging area up there. The geology that exists in that part of the state is very difficult when it comes to looking at that land for a cemetery. It's either rocky or swampy, or when you have to put the shovel into the ground for what we do, those two issues pose a challenge for us. So, you know, we're spending a lot of time up there. We're working hard with those local governments to try to find something that's owned so we don't have to acquire any property. But that search does continue. And last year, Senator Frederickson and I believe you, Mr. Chairman, introduced a bill that provided an appropriation of money that ultimately ended up being for design and possible land acquisition for these cemeteries. And in that language, Redwood County was identified as the location that we would look at for the southwest part of the state. It did require us to seek donated property to start with. What we did to undertake that search was we worked with the County Veterans Service Office in Redwood County to distribute information to the veterans service organizations in the area, as well as interested veteran advocates. Just let the word spread that we're looking for donated acreage of 60 to 120 acres. Along with that, we also did a kind of a media campaign and did a series of press releases in the local newspapers in Redwood County to see what we could find. And it did produce one individual that came forward with an offer of a donation, about 80 acres near Wabasso. We looked at the property that he had offered, and unfortunately, based on some preliminary study, there was the water table was quite high on his piece of ground there, and as well as a significant irrigation canal that ran through the property. So unfortunately, we had to decline his generous offer of a total donation of that property for our use. It was unfortunate that site couldn't have worked out a little better. As I said, it was the only offer that came forward. We set a deadline of September 30th to receive proposals for donations of property. And after that point, I should mention, we also worked with the DNR down in southwestern Minnesota to identify any potentially state-owned parcels. They worked with the county down there to also, you know, look at what they may have. Everything that the DNR could identify was pretty well wrapped up in wildlife management areas, scientific natural areas, and reinvest in Minnesota properties, things that had some pretty stringent requirements. And for us to come in and develop those properties for a cemetery doesn't seem to fit with what's required by law or conservation for those properties. So those two searches have not really produced the results that we may have hoped for. We have been approached by individuals with five potential sites in the area that would be available for purchase. We're currently evaluating those sites. One of them has been sold to another party, and another is through a little bit of detailed research has been determined to be unsuitable for impacted by the airport in Redwood Falls and some other things that initially show that property may be very difficult to develop as well. So I'm going to be down in the area next week looking at a couple additional properties. So again, that search in southwest Minnesota continues. The grant program, how that works with the federal government as far as cemetery grants are concerned, the grant program is a very robust program. It provides 100% of the funding for construction of a state veteran cemetery. So the state's responsible to obtain the property and, of course, operate the cemetery in the future. Currently, our cemetery requires between about $450,000 a year to operate. We do generate a little income with the payment, as I mentioned, that we receive for every veteran that we bury through the federal government. We also charge a small fee for the spouse or dependent of a veteran to generate revenue for our operation. It's not a large amount of revenue that we generate, but we do generate a little bit of revenue for our operation. The state is responsible also for fronting the money for design of these facilities, and the appropriation in the bonding bill last year provided us with those funds. So we were able to certify to the National Cemetery Administration that we have the design dollars available for both of these projects. And because of that, we are ranked as a priority one project on their list of pending state construction grant opportunities for veteran cemeteries. The list for federal fiscal year 10, which was signed by Secretary Shinseki at the end of September, our projects for Redwood County and Duluth are out of 60 total projects on this list. Those two projects are ranked number 14 and 15, respectively. The top 10 projects on that list, much like the Veterans Home Grant Program, are grants for existing cemeteries, needs that those cemeteries have to continue to operate. Maybe they're running out of developed burial sites or columbarium niches, which is an option for placement of cremated remains. So those projects take precedence over a project that's for the establishment of a new cemetery. The top 10 projects on the current list are for expansion or improvement projects. When you get to the start of the projects that are for the establishment of new cemeteries, these two projects are ranked number 4 and 5 on that list. So we're because of the funding in the appropriation last year, that gave us the catalyst to get these projects ranked in this group one, and are eligible for funding. The missing piece for us right now for these projects are sites, and we're working hard to get those sites in place because we can move these projects forward as soon as that happens. We have executed a contract with a design firm here in the Twin Cities for design of both of these projects. The engineering firm, we're excited to be working with them. They've just finished up a $25 million expansion project at Fort Snelling. This team is versed in what the National Cemetery Administration expects a cemetery to be both functionally, design-wise. They prepared an extensive master plan document for Fort Snelling National Cemetery, which is a difficult property. It's essentially filling up. There were small areas that were left to be developed, and what they put in place for a plan there was quite effective based on the challenges that they had. So bringing them on board for the state to design these two facilities, we think they're just going to do a fabulous job for us on essentially a blank canvas to be able to come into a 60 or 120-acre site and develop that thing from the get-go and to develop a very fine facility. In conclusion, there has been some expressed interest in a third project in southeast Minnesota. We were approached by Fillmore County at the end of 2009, and the deputy commissioner and myself met with their county commissioners, and it was just a question and answer session. They wanted some questions answered about how this grant program works and, you know, what it may mean for their county and what these facilities are like. And so we met with them, and they have some county property. I think at first they thought they might give it to us, but when they learned how much property we may need for a cemetery like this, they backed off that a little bit. They may be interested in giving it to us through a partial donation, but anyway, that's kind of an up-and-coming thing that you may hear something about during the session. There has been some expressed interest, and again, that area down there has a population large enough to, I would anticipate we'd be ranked right in the same vicinity of these other two projects. So with the support that the legislature has given us in the past and currently with these projects, you've put us in a real nice position to be able to compete with other states for this federal funding. So for that, I thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right, thank you. Questions from members? The Fillmore County project, I'm gathering from what you're saying, if they actually get serious and things start moving there, that won't affect the ranking of the current proposals at all, that there would be no direct effect there?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Until we would, the submittal of a pre-application, which basically establishes a communication between the National Cemetery System, the federal government, and the state on our interest in the project, is what generates inclusion on this list. And so until the time that we would submit a pre-application for an additional project, it would not rank on this list. At the time of that pre-application, you know, if that were to occur prior to July 1st, this coming summer, that project would be listed on this on the 2011 priority list for projects. Again, to be ranked in Group 1, we would have to be able to certify that the legislature has provided us funding for design. Otherwise, it would compete as a Group 2 project, which a lot of states are under for establishment of new cemeteries but have no appropriated design money. Essentially, projects 37 through 60 are all new cemetery projects, but no state legislative support in those states for those projects. So.
Okay. Anything from members? Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, members, Mr. Swantek is probably a little modest here. They just got a report that probably named them the finest, doing the finest job in the country on a veteran cemetery. And I spend a great deal of time there at official functions, and because my father-in-law was one of those 189 interred last year. So I want to just officially extend thanks for doing a fantastic job there. Everything we hope that's being done there is being done there. One quick small question. At present interment rates, how long before that cemetery is out of space?
Mr. Sondag.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doty, thank you. We've only used about 15% of our available property in Little Falls, so the future, you know, doesn't pose us any challenges. We will have a need to develop additional grave sites. We're not 100% developed at Little Falls. So, you know, looking forward, we will be able to submit additional grant requests for these expansion and improvement type projects. And expansion doesn't mean the cemetery is getting bigger. It means we need to expand into areas of the cemetery that are undeveloped for grave sites. So that will be something that we'll be looking for in the future. You know, there is a little state commitment required with that, but essentially placement of pre-placed burial vaults and construction of additional columbaria structure, which is an above-ground option for placement of cremated remains. Those type of things are eligible for funding through this same grant process, and so to develop those future sections of needed grave sites in Little Falls, we'll have the opportunity to seek some federal funding for that development. But we have a lot of space left in Little Falls.
Anything further? Well, thank you, Mr. Swantek. Appreciate it. And congratulations on the good job, too.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Pulaski. And we'll take the time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Mike Pugliese, Deputy Commissioner, Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I know we're running a little behind, so I'll go over some of the wonderful programs that we're offering our veteran community. I'll go through it pretty quickly, but please feel free to stop me, ask more questions if you want me to get more in depth. First one I'd like to discuss is the Minnesota CORE program. Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs has teamed up with Lutheran Social Services to create Minnesota Service Corps. serving veterans, military members, and their families through case management, outreach, referral, and education. The Minnesota Service Corps is a new nation-leading program designed to bring essential community-based services directly to veterans, military members, and their families across Minnesota at no cost to them. Due to its unique structure, this program will also provide resources to previously underserved rural areas around the state. We created CORE to address and remove several gaps and barriers that exist for veterans, military members, and their families when attempting to get the help they need. Some of those barriers and gaps include families. You know, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, unfortunately, they don't provide care for families. And we all know that the families suffer along with the veterans when they get called up and are serving over in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a lot of emotional issues that arise, financial issues that arise. And unfortunately, there was no place for them to go, especially if they didn't have the resources themselves to seek this out in the through a private facility. So now, they can go. The children can go. The family members can go, and they can get the help and the counseling that they need and take a holistic approach so that we can keep that family whole. Another barrier that exists is geography. You know, we have great VA medical centers, but there's a lot of, unfortunately, room between the VA and people that live in greater Minnesota. So what we wanted to do is remove that barrier also, so that if you're unable to travel to either St. Cloud VA Medical Center or the Minneapolis VA Medical Center, you can get care right in your community. LSS has offices throughout the state, so now it's very convenient, so that's another barrier we removed. And resources, you know, another barrier. A lot of families just don't have the resources to do this on their own. So this is a service that is free for them. So now that's another barrier removed so that they can go and get and seek the help that they need. And there's another barrier also. You know, a lot of veterans, unfortunately, especially from the Vietnam era, still aren't very comfortable coming forward and using those government-run programs and services. Well, this is another option for them. There's no tie to the government. It's through Lutheran Social Services, so they feel more comfortable going forward to that program, knowing that there's no affiliation with the government. There's a large array of counseling services offered by Lutheran Social Services, which includes marriage counseling, addiction counseling, family counseling, financial counseling, deployment and reintegration assistance, abuse, and other types of trauma counseling. As I said, LSS has offices throughout the state, which makes accessing their services easy. And if for some reason you can't make it to them, they will come to your home. So for our older veterans that are unable to transfer or even to a local facility, we can have them come to your home, and they do that on a regular basis. This new program works very closely with our county veteran service officers, and a large majority of the clientele is referred to LSS by the CVSOs. So far this fiscal year, the CORE program has assisted 700 veterans and or their families with a multitude of issues. You should have all been provided a brochure on it, hopefully. This brochure has been widely distributed throughout the state, and all of our partners are assisting with getting the word out on this new great service. This is a brand new service, and we're tweaking it as we go. As we hear about gaps that exist, as we hear about additional services that veterans and their families are in need of, we're enhancing this program and adding to it. It's been very well received. As I said, we work very closely with the CVSOs on this, and it's a good referral process. Once they go to LSS, that partnership between LSS staff and the CVSOs is developed, where they can help the CVSOs develop a claim for federal benefits. So it's a really nice partnership. If there's no questions on the CORE program, I'll move on to the State Soldiers Assistance Program.
Okay, any questions on this? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The State Soldiers Assistance Program is the longest standing program the department administers. It was created back in 1940. We have continuously updated and enhanced the program so that it meets the needs of today's veteran community. This program also works very closely with our CVSO partners in the counties, and all application for benefits must come from a CVSO with a recommendation. The reason we do that is it forces the veterans and their family members into that CVSO office where they can explore all the other opportunities that they might have for benefits. There are several forms of assistance provided through this program, which includes dental, optical, subsistence, and special needs. So far this fiscal year, we have assisted 1,841 veterans and or family members with dental care at a cost of $1.5 million, 765 veterans and or family members with optical needs with a cost of $286,000, 306 veterans and or family members with subsistence help at a cost of $182,000, and 1,232 veterans and or family members through our special needs program at a cost of $1.357 million. Through the special needs program, we were successful in keeping 394 veteran families in their homes. For the most part, the benefits provided through the State Soldier Assistance Program are time sensitive and we currently have a five-day turnaround time on all properly completed benefit applications received. The special needs portion is a new portion of the state soldier assistance program, and it's proven to be very effective. As I said, keeping 394 veteran families in their homes that were facing foreclosure. So it's really effective, and it really works, and we work very closely, again, with our county veteran service officers with this program. If there's no questions on this one, I'd like to move on to our claims and outreach.
Okay, any questions here? All right, thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our claims division represents veterans and their dependents who seek benefits from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs with regards to compensation, non-service-connected pension, insurance, or education benefits. Our claims division has provided this service for the department and the American Legion since 1943. Our outreach division was created in September 2004, and the person sitting here, Reggie Worlds, raise up your hand. Reggie Worlds, our Senior Director of Programs and Services, single-handedly, he created our outreach program. We stole him from Hennepin County. He was a County Veteran Service Officer there doing a fabulous job. We brought him into our department. He still does fabulous things, and our outreach department has grown dramatically since then. So you owe me. and the purpose of the outreach really is to educate and assist underserved veterans to access USDVA benefits and to provide referral to other agencies for additional services. The targeted population for outreach services includes, but is not limited to, communities of color, female, and homeless veterans. Our offices are located in St. Paul VA Regional Office at the Bishop Henry Whipple Federal Building. Additionally, the department has a branch office located at the Fargo, North Dakota VA Regional Office. Claims and outreach assistance are available at both locations. We work very closely, again, with our CVSO partners out in the counties, as that is where the claims are being generated and then sent to us for action. This fiscal year, the claims and outreach offices have seen a dramatic increase in their workload, and the following numbers reflect that. They attended 908 events, not just attended, but staffed. We have booths at those events, 908. 10,537 new powers of attorney. And let me quickly explain what that means. That means that was over 10,000 veterans that came forward wanting to make new applications for benefits through our office in 1 year, and that's dramatic. 23,737 pieces of mail were processed, 35,792 phone calls were received, 7,331 walk-in visits, which means there was just veterans that walked in to seek some information. And just under 20,000 VA rating decisions were reviewed and promulgated through our office last year. All this hard work equates to $226 million federal dollars that are brought into Minnesota annually through our office. I believe this service provides the biggest return on investment that any state or federal government program has to offer. It's tremendous, the work that goes on out at that claims office. They change lives daily. We still have World War II veterans walking in that didn't know they were entitled to anything, and by the time we're done with them, we have them at 100%, which is about $3,000 a month tax-free income, eligibility for all their medical needs through VA Medical Center. I mean, it really changes lives. It's dramatic. And we would love to take you all on a tour there someday so you can see the work going on. The next thing I'd like to talk on, if there's no questions on our claims and outreach, is our higher education veterans program.
Okay, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday, we debated the GAMC, and according to what I heard yesterday, there's some 8,000 veterans that are on general assistance medical care and are not somehow into the system. Is there some way that you can extend this outreach to get in contact with these people and get them into the system? Because I think if they're not getting medical care, there are probably other things that they're not receiving either. So if you can look into that and work with the people in the deal with GAMC, I'd really appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, yeah, you're exactly right. And I believe that Representative Thiessen might have submitted an amendment yesterday to the bill, which would require, if a veteran comes forward into the county for social service help, that social service department has to engage the county veteran service officer. We have one in every county, and we met with Representative Thiessen, and we're hoping he would do that, and I believe he did do that. That will certainly help the issue. Right now, there's not enough communication between the social service departments in the counties and that county veteran service officer. That has to be enhanced, and I think that language will help do that. Once we do that, once we get the veterans in front of the CVSOs, they take care of all their needs. They make sure they're enrolled in the VA. They apply for all the different benefits and services that they're entitled to. And I really think that bill is going to help do that. So, yeah, point well taken. Our higher education veterans program supports the success of veterans, current military members, and their families at Minnesota colleges and universities by providing on-site comprehensive information about benefits and resources, as well as creating institutional readiness in support of the unique needs of these students. Currently, we have 12 coordinators serving six regions. We have 59 on-campus veteran centers, which served 5,110 first-time individuals last year. Total of 56,245 contacts were made last year, which is a 44% increase over the year prior. Very busy program right now because there is a lot of dramatic changes with regards to the federal GI Bill. We have a lot of our Red Bulls and others returning home wanting to use their education benefits. And this is a program that sunsets next year. So we have to do everything we can to make sure this program continues to go because we still have people serving and coming back wanting to use those benefits. Our partnership for this program includes the University of Minnesota, where they have one office and six campus veteran centers, MinSCU, a great partner of ours on this program, 12 offices and 49 campus veteran centers, private colleges, we have four campus veteran centers, and our number one external referral resource, because once our campus reps engage with a veteran, besides just helping them with all their educational assistance, we make sure we refer them back to the county veteran service officer so that they can explore all those other benefits too. We also refer them to DEED for job assistance and other types of benefits. The program is also very involved with the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program. We've staffed 35 events, and through participation at the 30, 60, and 90-day programs, have assisted 3,584 families. We also provide college campus training, attended and participated in 31 events, and have trained 1,412 individuals. If there's no questions on this program, real quickly, I'll go over our Veterans Linkage Line.
Okay, questions? Oh, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Veterans Linkage Line is a toll-free, one-stop customer service line and website for all Minnesota veterans and their families located up in Perham. The service connects veterans and their families to important services and resources. Calls are answered from Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 8:45 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 3:15 p.m. Crisis connection counters provide service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, including holidays, for immediate crisis intervention and psychological counseling. This fiscal year, we have had over 89,000 contacts and inquiries made to our Link Vet program. And we have a problem solved rate of 95% within 24 hours, which we're very proud of. That's also a fairly new program. We've combined the call center with a one-stop website. We partnered with Minnesota Online, who's part of MinSCU up in Perham. They're doing a tremendous job, and we've been getting a lot of favorable remarks and comments regarding that service. We even have Red Bulls that are serving over in Iraq and Afghanistan able to seek out information and benefits and even apply for information and benefits through this program online while they're serving overseas. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty neat. With that, I'll take any questions you may have.
Okay, questions? Yeah, it sounds like it's a very good program, and I didn't realize everything that was going on. Thank you for all the information, and to you, Commissioner, and everyone else here too. Thanks for preparing and bringing the presentation to the committee today, and also congratulations on all the work you've done for veterans. I know that the workload for the department must have gone up tremendously over the last 2 years. That we sure appreciate, and also for the work being done with the veterans' homes, we appreciate that also. So.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, we're very thankful the support that you've given us in the past and continue to provide us. We're happy that we're this busy. We want to be this busy, and we couldn't do it without your support, so we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Anything further, members, before we adjourn? Okay, meeting adjourned.